patients who use Suboxone film, you know, they insert the film into their mouth, either buccally or sublingually, and they let the film rest there until it dissolves. Now, on average, it takes between 10 to 20 minutes for the film to dissolve. And so when you're using this drug on a daily basis, you can imagine how much acidic exposure your mouth gets. You can kind of think of it as keeping a piece of lemon in your mouth for 10 to 20 minutes. And so on average, we've seen that a lot of our clients experience these dental damage after about 6 months of use.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Cases for Causes, hosted by Obu Interactive. I'm Michael Turner, and today I'm joined by Jessica Wisorkowitz. Jessica is a distinguished attorney at Wallace Miller in Chicago, with expertise in mass torts, product liability, and personal injury litigation. Her legal career began in professional liability, specifically medical negligence, where she represented healthcare networks, physicians, and nurses throughout the litigation process. Today, Jessica stands as a fierce ally for plaintiffs, fighting against corporate giants, working to hold medical device and pharmaceutical manufacturers accountable. Her caseload spans critical battles, and her primary focus these days is on Suboxone, Paraquat, and Camp Lejeune, while also wrapping up settlement administration and 3M earplugs and Juul. Today, Jessica is joining us to discuss the emerging litigation around Suboxone, an oral film designed to help opioid addiction and pain management that is causing adverse side effects to those taking it. All right. Hi, Jessica. Thank you for taking the time to join me today. I'm looking forward to discussing Suboxone with you.
Thank you so much for having me on this podcast today, Michael. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to discuss this new litigation that I'm working on.
Okay, so let's get into the topic at hand, which is Suboxone. Suboxone is intended to curb opioid addiction. Could you start by telling us, from your perspective, you know, what it is and how does it work?
Yeah, so beginning in 2002, this drug was initially sold as a tablet. And then a few years later, in 2010, the manufacturers released the film version of the same drug. So our litigation today focuses on Suboxone film specifically and its association with dental damage. So Suboxone is composed of two main ingredients, buprenorphine and naloxone. Buprenorphine is the active ingredient that actually treats the addiction, right? So buprenorphine is a partial opioid agonist. And so in comparison to opioids, they are full agonists of the mu receptor in the brain. And so in comparison, buprenorphine, because it's a partial agonist, it only partially activates the opioid receptors in the brain. And so the theory is that it helps treat the addiction by only partially activating those receptors in an attempt to reduce the cravings and the severe withdrawal that opioid addiction often entails. And then the second active ingredient is naloxone, also commonly known as Narcan. And that's in the mix of this drug in order to help prevent abuse, right? So the naloxone being incorporated in the drug really prevents individuals from being able to crush it up and just use it in a manner that is not prescribed. An important thing to keep in mind and relevant to this litigation is that the active ingredient, buprenorphine, can be administered in several different ways to patients. One of those is transdermal patch. Centered in this litigation is the film and tablet versions, which can be administered either buccally, which is by your cheek, or sublingually, which is under your tongue. And then also you can receive buprenorphine via implant or injection. And so the reason why these alternative methods are important is because as we pursue a design defect claim in this case, we're trying to show and prove, right, that you can still get the opioid addiction treatment that you need, but in a manner that is much safer for the patient.
Got it. So it started as a pill, and now it's an oral film, which, like you said, is where we're focusing in on and what this litigation is centered around. Can you explain a little bit about the origin of the oral film and why the manufacturer changed from, you know, the pill form to this oral film that's now causing issues?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, Suboxone was initially sold as a tablet beginning in 2002. Then the manufacturers began developing a film version of this drug in 2006, and it came on the market in 2010. Now, the manufacturer cited safety concerns for the tablet and alleged that the film version would be safer. They claimed that the film was individually packaged and therefore it would be more difficult for children to inadvertently access it as compared to the tablet version. Now, a few years ago, these manufacturers were faced with antitrust litigation for product hopping. This means that the manufacturers were alleged to have switched from the tablet to film for financial reasons and not patient safety, as they claim. Now, I don't practice in the area of antitrust, so I can't speak into much depth about that, but generally, a product hop is when the manufacturer of a drug develops what you call, quote-unquote, a new version of the drug in order to extend its patents and continue having exclusive rights to sell the drug and thereby prevent generic competition. And so in this case here, you know, the manufacturers knew that the tablet patent was going to expire in 2009, which naturally means now generic competition can come on the market and that'll, you know, naturally decrease their profits, right? So what they did is they started working on a new and improved version of the drug in 2006. So that way, by the time the tablet patent expired, the generic competition and generic competition could begin. These manufacturers would already have a patent for the film that they could then continue, you know, having exclusive rights over selling and making more money off of.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty dense and often, you know, can lead to these issues that we see now. So it hits the market in 2010 as the film. Is that correct?
Correct. Yep.
So how long after that do the first issues pop up, the first side effects start to become apparent? And can you talk a little bit about what they are too, what people experience after they took this film?
So when a pharmaceutical drug is on the market, there is a component of FDA regulations, right? A pharmaceutical drug company's ability to market and sell products, adverse event reporting. And so what that means is, you know, as before a drug comes to market, right, there's preclinical and clinical testing that's done. But in reality, you're not going to know what the real side effects of a drug are until it's, used out in the public and across all kinds of different patients, right? Because in clinical settings, things are often much more controlled. And so you may not see all of the side effects. And so all of that is to say that once a product is on the market, physicians have a duty to report, you know, adverse events that they see in their patients that are using this product. And so the point is that, you know, after Suboxone film came on the market in 2010, it didn't take too long for adverse events to start building up where we are seeing that patients have these dental damages. Now, when you first see these adverse events, you know, you have to do some studies and see, is there a causal relationship as opposed to just an association? But as we develop our case and, you know, you'll see in future court documents, right, we have some evidence to believe that this knowledge was, that the companies had this knowledge much earlier than as compared to when they updated the label. And so in terms of the damages related in this case, the way that that Suboxone works is that there is a citric acid and sodium citrate in the formulation, which acts as a buffer for a low pH to maximize absorption of buprenorphine, the active ingredient, while simultaneously minimizing the absorption of naloxone. And so the pH of Suboxone film is 3.5. And for reference, anything below a pH of 7 is acidic. And so the problem with these acidic buffers, which are needed in order to make the film version work, is that they lead to dental erosion and decay. And so patients who use Suboxone film, you know, they insert the film into their mouth, either buccally or sublingually, and they let the film rest there until it dissolves. Now, on average, it takes between 10 to 20 minutes for the film to dissolve. And so when you're using this drug on a daily basis, you can imagine how much acidic exposure your mouth gets. You can kind of think of it as keeping a piece of lemon in your mouth for 10 to 20 minutes. And so on average, we've seen that a lot of our clients experience these dental damage after about 6 months of use.
That's a really good analogy with the lemon, especially, you know, for people who might be listening to this and kind of understand the general premise that it's, you know, it's hurting people's teeth and whatnot, but the lemon really puts it in context. And I think an important question is for somebody who is reliant on Suboxone for helping to treat their opioid addiction, is that something they should cease taking, or does it really depend on their situation?
So I'm not a medical professional, so I can't really advise on medical treatment per se. However, from the perspective of our legal theories of the litigation, As I mentioned earlier, there are other alternative methods for administering the active ingredient, buprenorphine, to patients, such as patches, implants, and injections. And so that's part of our design defect claim in the case, where we allege that Suboxone film is more dangerous than other drugs and therapies designed to treat opioid use disorder, and it causes an unreasonable risk of injury. So all of that is to say that, you know, there are other options available for patients who need treatment for opioid addiction, and it doesn't have to be the film version, which unnecessarily harms patients, right? There's other ways to get buprenorphine to the patient in a much more safe way.
And in terms of that litigation and where we're at currently, it's, you know, it's public news now that a multi-district litigation has been formed, and that's a critical step in these kind of emerging litigations. What does it mean for somebody who might have been injured by Suboxone and who might be listening to this?
So this happens often when you have claims that relate to, you know, either the same drug or medical device. Courts, once they start seeing a lot of lawsuits that have some similar legal theories surrounding the same product, will consolidate these cases. So as you said, you know, the multi-district litigation was actually just recently formed earlier this year, and the cases were assigned to the Honorable Philip Calabrese in the Northern District of Ohio. We actually have our first case management conference next week on March 7th, and that's when we'll begin working out the logistics of the litigation, both with the court and defense counsel. I'm actually a part of the leadership slate that has been proposed to the court, and if granted, it'll be my first court-appointed leadership role as a member of the steering committee. So for anyone listening to this, you know, if you've used Suboxone film and you've suffered dental damage, I think patients and injured parties should be aware that now is the time to connect with an attorney. And part of the reason is because the manufacturers of the Suboxone film updated the prescribing information to note that there is an association between the film product and dental damage in June of 2022. And so the longer you wait, things like the statute of limitations can adversely impact your case.
Yeah, I had seen that in some marketing material that kind of June of 2022 was that when they started adding a warning label of sorts, or just kind of a disclaimer?
Yeah, so there's numerous parts to a drug, right? You have the label and the prescribing information where the prescribing physician is in charge of, you know, reading all that information and then transferring that information over to the patient when you have the informed consent discussion, right? You consider the benefits of a drug, the cons of it, and then make a decision whether the benefits outweigh the risks and you decide to take it. And so in this case specifically, the defendants in our case updated the prescribing information, which is a part of the label in the drug.
And in terms of other, you know, I don't want to get too into criteria, but they had to have taken it before 2022 to join this lawsuit as it stands right now?
Not necessarily. Patients who began after June 2022 can potentially have a viable claim, but it's really a case-specific analysis. So we would, you know, analyze the case with the client based on when they began using the drug and also when they became aware of the association between their dental damage and their use of Suboxone film. And, you know, way too complex to get into today, but there's a bunch of different legal avenues. You can always try to save a case, even if it seems like there's going to be hurdles. So I would still recommend, you know, regardless of what time period somebody began using it, if you have dental damage, you should, I would highly encourage just consulting an attorney and seeing if there's a viable claim there.
It's great advice. So it seems that in addition to Suboxone, you know, you've worked on some pretty difficult litigations. I mean, the science is super complex from what you've just told me. How did you decide to focus on Suboxone as your next big project?
I believe that this litigation is really important because our clients have been now twice victimized by Big Pharma, first in hooking them on opioids and then now saddling them with devastating dental injuries from Suboxone film. You know, before I began working in the area of plaintiff's mass torts, I'm not really sure how much of the public realizes that a majority of individuals that suffer from opioid addiction today were actually brought to that road by what seemed to be an innocent prescription from their doctors. So often our clients underwent a traumatic injury, a surgery, some sort of medical event that caused a lot of pain and required some type of pain management. And given what Big Pharma has accomplished in making the public and medical community believe that opioids were not addictive, or, you know, not as addictive, many patients were in fact prescribed opioids in a manner that was not safe, and then they developed an addiction. So I often say, you know, these patients were essentially prescribed legal heroin. So I've really dedicated my career to helping spread awareness about the opioid epidemic and its lasting effects in an effort to change things going forward. So patients are more knowledgeable about, you know, the drugs and medical devices that are out on the market. So the public has a better understanding and therefore more empathy towards those that suffer from opioid addiction. And at the end of the day, to hold wrongdoers accountable, right? The only way we can make change is to hold people accountable for when they do bad acts and then hope that they improve their actions going forward, especially when those actions impacted millions of people and caused countless amounts of deaths across the U.S.
Wow. So, Jessica, the world of mass torts is complex, to say the least, and each litigation is so different. How did you end up being involved in mass torts to begin with?
So I started my legal career actually on the defense side, doing defense medical malpractice. So I represented doctors, nurses, healthcare industries, and litigation. And I did that for just under 2 years. And interestingly, one of my final assignments while practicing defense med mal, I was working with a partner on a presentation we were going to give to nurses and doctors at a hospital surrounding the opioid epidemic. So I was charged with just researching, you know, the epidemic, learning about Big Pharma's conduct and causing it, and then how prescribers can or can't be implicated in that epidemic, right? And so while I started doing that research, I actually became just like really mad, right? Learning about the truth and what Big Pharma has done in terms of getting a bunch of people hooked on a drug that should have never been, you know, on the market or prescribed the way it is. So I, you know, started watching a little bit more documentaries, doing more research, and it really just lit a fire in me. And I decided that I really wanted to spend my career working on behalf of injured individuals. So I made the change to the plaintiff side. And as I began looking for, you know, my next career step, I came across the firm that I'm working at now, and they handle complex litigation, plaintiff's mass torts, and class action type of law. And I just, you know, at first glance, I didn't really understand what plaintiff's mass tort is. I think often practitioners, until you get into this space, it's sometimes hard to conceptualize what mass torts is all about. But I just really fell in love with the practice area, mostly because I think, you know, it's hard to make a difference in the world, but little by little with these cases, we really do make a change, and changes that you can actually see in front of you, right? Products are either warnings are added, so patients are more informed about the product that they're taking. Products are taken off the market sometimes. And so you're really making a difference for consumers at a large scale, which is, you know, really fun to work on those kind of cases that have such a large impact. And I think it's for good causes, right? At the end of the day, all of us use products, whether it's medical products or recreational things like that. And so we all expect these products to be safe, right? If a company is going to put out something and make money off of it, we hope that they would put it the due diligence to make sure that it is as safe as it possibly can be. So I think it's really important to hold these large corporations accountable for when they don't necessarily prioritize patient safety, you know, and kind of look at profits more often.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, when I started working in legal marketing and started learning more and more about how these things get recalled and these products left and right, and texting my family members like, all right, don't use this, don't use that. So we definitely appreciate the work of on the legal side. What was the first mass tort you worked on? And then maybe what was one that you're still working on that is pretty significant, if you could share a little bit about that?
Yeah. So another litigation that I'm working on is the Paraquat herbicide litigation. It was the very first case that I began working on when I joined Wallace Miller. And I'm still working on it today because it's probably not a surprise to many people. Litigation takes many, many years, right? So we began litigating in 2022, and here we are 2 years later, you know, still working on written and oral discovery. And so the herbicide, the Paraquat litigation surrounds a restricted use herbicide, and it is alleged to be linked to Parkinson's disease. And so you have a lot of farmers and agricultural workers across the U.S. that used Paraquat for many, many years, starting in the late 1960s. And then as more research is done, right, and people start developing what we call latent diseases. So you don't immediately develop Parkinson's when you're exposed to this product, but after many years and lots of exposure, the chemical, you know, gets into the brain and then starts impacting the dopamine neurons, which when you lose those, that's what causes Parkinson's disease. And so I think it's, you know, a really important litigation because just like we've been talking about, right, if a company is going to put a product out there, we want to make sure that it's as safe as it possibly can be. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence in the case, which will come out when we get to trial, right, as to what did the company know and when did they know it? And then when did they decide to share it or not share it with the public, right? And that's a huge contention point in the Paraquat litigation. And so, you know, it's just important to hold these big corporations accountable because their conduct impacts people at such a mass scale, right? You have so many individuals across the U.S. who work hard to provide for their families, right? Farmers and agriculture workers who provide for really the economy, right? All the food that we eat. And now they're suffering from horrible, horrible symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And I think part of that could have been preventable, right? If the company maybe warned about the link earlier, and provided better instructions as to how to use the product in a more safe manner. And so, yeah, it's a really important litigation and I'm proud to be a part of it. We're litigating in Pennsylvania State Court right now, and we have upcoming trials starting in early of next year. So that's always exciting when you finally get the trial date on the books, because that's when you, you know, could finally put some pressure on getting the litigation moving.
Being located in the Midwest, was Paraquat exposure more prevalent there than other parts of the country, for example?
The Midwest is definitely a big, big part of it. But we also saw a lot of exposure on the West Coast as well in California. So really farming kind of tends to happen all over the U.S. So you have claimants from everywhere. And that's kind of another fun part of working in mass torts is the ability to represent individuals from all across the U.S. and then the ability to co-counsel and work with lawyers from all across the U.S., right? So you get to learn from and build on the experience of, you know, the best of the best across the country.
Well, Jessica, we covered a lot today, and I thank you for your time again joining us. For those who may want to get in contact with you, either maybe they're somebody who's dealt with some Suboxone effects, or there may be another attorney who's curious about more information on the litigation, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
I'd be happy to, you know, collaborate, whether it's with other counsel or help a potential client out if they've been impacted by this. And so the best way to reach me is probably by email. It's jw@wallacemiller.com. And if you just go to our firm website, which is wallacemiller.com, you'll find all that information in my bio on there. And I would strongly encourage anybody who has any questions to reach out. Like I mentioned, you know, if everything works out and the court accepts, I'll be part of the leadership slate in this case. And so we're going to be, you know, working hard, sleeves rolled up, hitting the ground running. And so happy to collaborate with others as needed on that.
All right. Sounds great. And we hope to have you on again at some point, too.
Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks. We'd like to thank Jessica again for taking the time to join us on Cases for Causes. Our discussion around Suboxone and even Paraquat and the world of mass torts was enlightening. If you'd like to learn more about OBU, we can be found at obuinteractive.com. That's obuinteractive.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and other social media at OBU Interactive. And I can be reached directly at michael@obuinteractive.com. We'll see you next time on Cases for Causes.